From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich defending his attacks against presidential hopeful Mitt Romney.
Crony capitalism, where people pay each other off at the expense of the rest of the country, is not free enterprise. And raising questions about that is not wrong.
To drive home that point, the Gingrich Super PAC has just released a 28-minute video polemic excoriating Romney as a corporate raider who callously killed jobs as head of Bain Capital, a private equity firm. Ed Kilgore in The New Republic called it a heat-seeking missile aimed directly at the white working class id. Certainly it was a gift to Romney competitors like Texas Governor Rick Perry.
And I happen to think that companies like Bain Capital could have come in and helped these companies if they truly were venture capitalists, but they're not. They're vulture capitalists.
The interesting part in all this is that this unexpected boon to Romney haters, playing on computer screens everywhere and backed up by political ads all over South Carolina, has created a different split in the GOP than we've seen between old-line Republicans and Tea Partiers on Capitol Hill. Warring Republicans seem to be engaged, however politically motivated, in a scorched-earth argument over the impact of unbridled market capitalism. A temporary blip? Maybe. But hearing such arguments in the mouths of conservatives does suggest a change in the wind. Historian Charles Postol says it could merely be a Newt-generated dust storm that will pass.
His goal here is simply to hurt Romney. And I'm not sure there's any lasting significance to this, except, you know, there's a reason why Newt Gingrich is considered a bomb thrower in his party.
The National Review said the fact that Bain's business practices were both legit and productive doesn't mean they weren't distasteful and politically toxic. So it isn't just a grudge match with Gingrich. There seems to be something else going on.
What's going on is those sections of the Republican Party which don't like Romney are using the Bain equity firm as a political cudgel. People who are discontent with Romney wouldn't have a case to make without the context that this is 4 years into the great financial collapse brought about by Wall Street irresponsibility to a large extent. It's exactly the type of discussion that the Occupy Wall Street movement has pushed, effectively so, because it resonates so widely.
This is from the Gingrich Super PAC film. It seems that the Republican opponents are engaging in class warfare.
Wall Street's corporate raiders made billions of dollars.
Private equity leaders getting rich at the expense of American workers.
Nothing was spared. Nothing mattered but greed.
They could patch this up relatively quickly and without a lot of damage. But I think it shows the underlying vulnerability. Somewhere along the line, the Republicans are going to have to retool their message to address these questions of economic inequality and the role of Wall Street and its misbehavior. They can't just stick with, we should tax them less and deregulate them more. I don't think that's a viable political message over the long haul. And I think this particular bloodletting within the Republican Party shows that we're going to have a very tumultuous campaign, and these issues are going to be right in the middle of it.
There's already been a backlash. You have people like Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Jim DeMint, Mike Huckabee, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Wall Street Journal, all arguing against the Republicans who have criticized Mitt Romney. And in fact, Nikki Haley, who is the governor of South Carolina, said recently, we have a real problem when we have Republicans talking like dang Democrats against the free market.
That's the conundrum they're up against. It is a problem for their party. This isn't the first time this has happened, though. In the original populist revolt of the 1890s, the populists pushed against economic inequality. They wanted income taxes on the top 1%. As a party, they lost out. But in doing so, both Democrats and Republicans had to take on chunks of the populist program. And that's why we have the progressive income tax. That's where we get banking regulation. That's where we get a whole series of measures to help the middle class and working people.
Many of which have been subsequently swept away.
Yes, and that's one of the most fascinating features of the elections right now, The debates that took place in the 1890s and the early 1900s are being replicated today. On the one side, you have Len Beck and the Tea Party talking about what set America off on the wrong foot was the Progressive Era. Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, that's where we got the income tax and all the bad things that have come to America. And on the other side, you have Barack Obama giving a speech last month about trying to resurrect the specter of Teddy Roosevelt. So now we're living in the second Gilded Age, when we have new levels of economic inequality unseen for a century, and those old debates are still with us.
Getting a sense of historical deja vu?
As in 1896 and William Jennings Bryan versus McKinley, something like that, yes.
Charles, thank you very much.
Been nice talking to you.
Charles Postol teaches history at San Francisco State University, and he is the author of The Populist Vision.
Mitt Romney has another problem, a four-legged one. Back in 1983, Romney took his family on a 12-hour road trip from Boston to Canada, with one member of the family, an Irish setter named Seamus, riding the roof of the car. Boston Globe magazine writer Neil Swidey dug up the Seamus story 5 years ago and featured it prominently in a series profiling Romney. Poor Seamus is long departed, but the media refused to let the anecdote die. New York Times columnist Gail Collins has referenced Seamus 30 times. And here's Fox News' Chris Wallace. Is that a lump in his throat?
I have a yellow lab named Winston. I would no sooner put him in a kennel on the roof of my car than I would one of my children. Question, what were you thinking?
Swidey revisited the Seamus anecdote and his role in its dissemination in an article this week in the Boston Globe magazine. Neil, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here, Bob.
Let's just clarify this to get started. The dog wasn't just like lashed to the roof of the station wagon. He was an elaborate station wagon roof dog carrier complete with windscreen, right?
Exactly. And that's been one of the most preposterous and hilarious spinoffs of the anecdote is people have this image of the dog lashed with an old clothesline to the roof of the car.
However much dogs like to luxuriate in the wind, Seamus had some problems on this trip.
He did. About midway through it, there was some gastric distress, I guess. And Mitt's oldest son, Tag, who was in the back of the station wagon, first noticed this brown liquid coming down the back windshield and screamed, "Gross, Dad."
The reason we're discussing this, though, is that the story of Seamus continues to find its way into the narrative. And that's all thanks to you. First of all, congratulations.
Thanks.
Why does this 30-year-old anecdote continue to resonate?
There are really two answers. The first is for people who have to confront and grapple with the technicalities of healthcare reform and tax policy and jobs bills, it's a lot easier to form an opinion, a passionate opinion about a dog on the roof of the car. And you can immediately sort of see where you fall on that continuum of whether you think it's outrageous or whether you kind of understand it. The second thing, and probably more interesting, is that here Romney is making his second run for presidency, a very well-known national figure, and yet he remains this enigma. And that has to do with, I think, the fact that he emerges out of these really mysterious subcultures, the Mormon church and private equity finance, which people don't really know a lot about. And here was an authentic, real moment from his life that I think is sort of a shortcut to getting a sense of how the guy operates.
Well, on the subject of shortcuts, what did you think at the time that it meant?
I think it's an insight into Mitt Romney's operating system. Here was an unscripted moment, and how does he respond to it? He responds to it by coolly pulling off the highway into a gas station, borrowing a hose, washing down Seamus and the car, and then ushering Seamus right up back into the carrier and getting back behind the wheel and moving on. And the way he does it is with logic and with an utter absence of emotion. A lot of critics have focused on the first half of it, and I've always thought the second half is actually more interesting. What happens after Seamus's problems rear themselves and how Mitt handles it?
So back in 2007, you surely knew that this story would not be taken only at face value, that it would mutate. And that it would be used as ammunition by those who would portray Mitt Romney as the Michael Vick of presidential candidates. still wound up as your lead. You feel any compunction about that at this stage?
The only compunction I feel is maybe I have a heightened awareness now of the extent to which people would focus on that to the exclusion of everything else, including all nuance in it. I mean, in this piece I wrote just this past week, I mentioned some of the mythology and factual errors that have been reported and then re-reported by the media. The first time I heard the story from a family friend, he thought he remembered hearing that Romney had actually driven through a car wash. There have been partisans, anti-Romney people, who have perpetuated this notion that that's actually what really happened. So there are all kinds of Twitter chatter about the car wash.
I guess what I want to find out from you is, in this world where partisans are free to cut and paste as they wish, no matter how irresponsibly and cynically, do reporters have to take responsibility and fashion their stories in a way to be least useful for the forces of naked partisanship?
It's a fascinating question, but I would flip that back to you and ask, what's the natural extension of that? To make them impenetrable from abuse, you also make them impenetrable to readers and to viewers and to listeners. You know, stories need to breathe and they need to be human. And I think people in general identify with other people in their moments of imperfection. I think that's one of Romney's problems, is that he does present this sort of airbrushed quality. And not to say you need to know about pet anecdotes from 30 years ago necessarily, but you need insight. And to the extent that we can try to do that, I think we have to, and hope that there are enough people out there willing to look for and be interested in the real truth.
Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Neil Swidey is a writer for the Boston Globe magazine.
Coming up, the Supreme Court considers bad words and bare butts.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments over the constitutionality of the government's rules regarding indecent programming. In particular, what's at issue are fines levied against broadcasters for so-called fleeting expletives and nudity seen and heard on their channels during the hours deemed safe for children. That includes naughty word eruptions at award shows.
That's really, really brilliant.
And nudity, like the type seen in this 2003 NYPD Blue episode, where an actress disrobes for a shower and is discovered by a small boy.
Sorry.
The issue has bounced back and forth in the federal courts, and once again, the Supremes are considering how or if the FCC should regulate the family hour. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate. Dahlia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did the court seem to buy into the notion that broadcast TV should be one place where parents can allow their small children to watch without fear of being exposed to who knows what?
Unequivocally, yes. It was quite surprising. I counted at least four justices who felt really strongly. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts says the fact that there are 300 other channels that are purveyors of smut is all the more reason to preserve this one safe space where you can plop your toddler down at 8 o'clock at night and know that nobody's going to drop the F-bomb.
Although the safe space argument was kind of deflated when one of the lawyers for the networks pointed out that there were nude statuary right in the chambers of the Supreme Court.
This is indisputably, in 12 years of court watching, the greatest moment of my life. Seth Waxman represents ABC TV, and he starts talking about how there's questions and complaints before the FCC about the broadcast of the last Olympic Games opening ceremony where there's nude statuary, and then starts pointing out all the naked buttocks around the interior of the courtroom. There's a frieze, a big stone frieze all around the interior, and he literally starts to say, there's a buttock here, there's a bare buttock there, and all the justices start gaping skyward to look at these bare buttocks.
Now, of course, the answer might be from the justices, this is neoclassical art. But that's one of the issues that the court has to confront.
And that's the complaint that both Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Elena Kagan try to make very strongly, that if you're going to go ahead and start fining people for shots of nudity, do it even-handedly and across the board. Because by fining ABC for one shot of naked buttocks, but allowing Private Ryan or allowing Schindler's List to go unsanctioned, you're setting a standard that's both arbitrary, and this is the deeper point, chills the networks, makes the networks very reluctant to ever air anything controversial because they don't know what the standard is. Elena Kagan says, is the policy just, quote, that nobody can use dirty words or nudity except for Steven Spielberg?
But there's a difference between arbitrary and capricious and nuanced, isn't there?
That's exactly right. And the Chief Justice really responds to that. He says, look, you don't want us to go around saying you can say this but not that. You can show a hip but not a rear end. So what we're going to do is embrace the fact that context matters. And as the Chief Justice said, there's a difference between Nicole Richie dropping the F-bomb and Saving Private Ryan.
What's going to happen? What will the ruling be?
I think there's a very good chance that some version of the FCC policy stands and that the court really, really takes up the notion that some speech is not acceptable in some places, at least as regards network television.
If you're right, and the court sends this back to the FCC saying, you know, you're pretty well doing it right as it is, it's all going to come down to politics and the culture wars. If there is a conservative administration, the FCC will be at pains to be less lenient. And if there is a liberal administration, the FCC will be more forgiving.
This policy change to start going after fleeting epithets, to start going after tiny flashes of nudity, really happened in 2004 in the Bush White House. And that was clearly a political climate that drove that change. But I think it's really important to caveat that with the observation that the Obama administration has been as zealously defending this policy as the Bush administration. But beyond that, and this was a point that was made by Fox's lawyer, he says, look, this isn't determined by politics at all. This is determined by the market. If we show nudity, we will lose advertisers. We will lose viewers. And so we're self-policing enough that we don't need the government to be involved at all.
Dahlia, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick covers legal issues for Slate.
Last month, a crowd of some 25,000 in a Moscow square were protesting the conduct of recent parliamentary elections when some people saw, hovering in the sky, a pulsating object with five tendrils, a UFO. Actually, it was a remote-controlled camera platform, a drone. Very soon, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is expected to update the regulations governing the use of small drones here. Once limited to the realm of high-tech espionage and stealth military strikes, now you can buy unmanned and presumably unarmed aircraft at your local mall. Matt Waite teaches journalism at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he recently launched the Drone Journalism Lab. He says that once only deep-pocketed news outlets could put eyes in the skies, but even they didn't have, and may never have, access to the technology that's rolling out today.
In July, I went to a digital mapping conference out in San Diego. It was a European company called Gatewing that had a fully autonomous aircraft with a high-resolution camera in it, and they have this product video that is absolutely mind-blowing.
Imagine being able to achieve highly accurate mapping whenever and wherever needed. Introducing the Gatewing X100.
One guy pulls this aircraft out, puts it on a catapult, pulls out a tablet computer, draws a little square around the area he wants it to fly and where it's going to take off from and where he wants it to land. He puts that information into the aircraft, launches it in the air, and the aircraft just goes and does it.
And you took out your credit card immediately.
Yeah, I did. I was like, how much? And they said, it's $65,000, and it's completely illegal in the United States. I put my credit card away.
And then you saw this thing being sold at the mall, and it didn't cost $65,000.
Just a few hundred dollars. And I actually had heard about it and got on the internet. And sure enough, here are all these people who are taking this thing and modifying it and adding these cameras that were producing just really stunning images. the applications for reporting were immediately apparent to me. Imagine having that available to you in Joplin, Missouri, after the tornadoes went through there. You could fly the entire damage path, then go to the local property authorities and get a map of every property in the city, lay it down over top of that image of the ground, and you could do really interesting data on what was damaged. Let's say you're a reporter in Japan and you're not exactly interested in tromping around the Fukushima nuclear power plant, but you could take a drone and have an onboard Geiger counter taking readings. Things like that I don't think have been explored at all.
The gate wing, you said, is illegal in the United States, as opposed to this little parrot AR thing that sold at Brookstone.
Which is only slightly legal. The law as it stands right now is that remote control aircraft pilots can't fly near people or go above 400 feet. They also cannot use them for commercial purposes. Journalism is considered a commercial purpose. The law has not caught up to the fact that there are these inexpensive aircraft that can do commercial things. There are industries that are just waiting to jump in and make a lot of money doing this. Agriculture, oil and gas, everybody is really interested to hear what the FAA has to say this month.
So if oil companies get to use it, then maybe journalists can hop on that back.
I am hoping for that.
Given the prescriptions of the law, what kind of technology are you working with now at the lab?
We've got the quadricopter that we're playing around with. Quadricopter has four rotors on it. You'll hear people talking about quadricopters, hexacopters, and octocopters, 4, 6, and 8 rotors. Honestly, I'm finding the AR drone to be pretty unstable and pretty underpowered. I've seen other filmmakers using hexacopters and octocopters with a digital SLR camera on there to be able to produce some really stunning images. When we will actually get to cover news with it, and it really depends on the FAA. The other things that we're looking at are balloons. There's a group of people called the Public Laboratory. They produce some imagery out of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. They sent this balloon up, and you can see in this image that they took where the oil boom was and where the oil was behind it, looking all horrible, and then relatively clean water on the other side of it. For about $100 worth of materials, it was pretty stunning. And there's no FAA rules about that.
About a balloon.
Yeah.
Do you have any concerns or fears about drone technology, particularly the privacy aspects?
I have a litany of concerns. People's reactions tend to be on a continuum. One side is, this is completely creepy. And then there's the other side of, this is amazingly cool. And I think that you are naive if you don't believe this is just a little bit creepy. Most people are uncomfortable by law enforcement having an ever-present eye in the sky. Since there are these things like the remote control platforms that you can get at any hobby store, plus the sophisticated cameras that we all have in our smartphones, now you have the people watching the police watching the people.
Isn't that better than when just the police were watching the people?
I think that is good. And I think if you try to limit the upside of tools because of these perceived downsides, I think you really limit what the future can hold. What I'm interested in doing, and I haven't had time to do this yet, is go back and look at what we were writing about when long telephoto lenses were introduced. You wouldn't send a photographer to somebody's home and try to take pictures with a long telephoto lens into the backyards.
Unless you're Britney Spears.
Most of us will agree that's a pretty disgusting violation of her privacy. Just because you can do that with a drone doesn't make it any more right. Trespassing is still trespassing.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt Waite is a journalism professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and founder of the Drone Journalism Lab.
We've spent a fair amount of time on this show talking about the anti-sec movement, the hacker community that releases information lifted from supposedly secure sites in order to expose security lapses before those lapses are exploited by actors with truly sinister motives. One such, Neville Maskelyne, who took on the world's most cutting-edge communications technology and exposed its backdoors on the very day it was introduced to the public. This took place not at this week's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, but in the lecture hall of London's Royal Institution in 1903. Yes, Maskelyne, a magician and inventor, was a proto-hacker who 109 years ago made a spectacle of Guglielmo Marconi's introduction of the wireless telegraph. Marconi's assistant, Ambrose Fleming, was performing that demo, and as Paul Marks of New Scientist explains, it was supposed to be the unveiling of a technological miracle.
The idea was that Ambrose Fleming would receive wireless messages relayed from Cornwall, 300 miles away, and they would be read to the audience, and they would be a marvel because they would arrive without having come over the wires that everybody knew were needed for telegrams.
And then what happened?
Marconi claimed that nobody else could listen in to the Morse code being transmitted. But just before Fleming's demonstration was due to start, one of his assistants heard a strange ticking sound, Morse code. It was saying the word rats over and over again. And then it got to a little ditty that the attackers, if you want to call them attackers, had put together, which said there was a young fellow of Italy who diddled the public quite prettily. The point being made there was that actually anyone could tune in to the same frequencies, broadcast on them, and get in there.
Like having a police scanner or me going on to Gmail using the wireless signal from my neighbor's router.
Yep. The guy who had set this up, Neville Maskelyne, had done so at the behest of the cable telegram industry, which was completely beside itself at the thought that it was about to lose its monopoly. They ran global flotillas of cable ships to lay cable around the oceans to connect the world, and they didn't want this Marconi upstart coming along and pulling their business from under them.
This gets to the questions of Neville Maskelyne's motives. Maskelyne had some malice behind his actions, no?
Not exactly. He was demonstrating a genuine security failing of wireless telegraphy, and that was that anybody could tune into it and transmit their own messages or intercept somebody else's messages. Marconi rather foolishly denied that that was possible. And it was only Marconi's insistence that it was secure that had Maskelyne putting together a system to prove otherwise. A lot of people do that these days. They break into a bank security system just to prove that there's something wrong with it. And in some ways, Maskelyne did a pretty good public service.
Didn't Maskelyne have an ongoing beef with Marconi about Marconi's patent control of certain technology that was interfering in Maskelyne going about his business as a fake mentalist?
Maskelyne was trying to do his own thing by pioneering various forms of radio technology, but he couldn't implement his own ideas and develop his own technology because Marconi had some basic patents that froze him out. He was certainly embittered towards him, let's put it that way.
So he gets this dream opportunity to make a fool of his nemesis. What happened that day to Marconi and his business?
Well, nothing immediately happened because the audience were unaware of it. But what happened was Ambrose Fleming was very upset that a demonstration in this hallowed hall of technology and science had somehow been impugned, that he wrote a letter to the Times demanding that the readers tell him if they knew who had done it. And a few days later, Maskelyne writes to the Times gleefully confessing that he did it and that he did so for the good of the public, because if they start sending their telegrams wirelessly, anybody can read them.
So Fleming, who was the physicist and Marconi's employee, actually outed the event for the security lapse that it was.
He did indeed. If he'd kept quiet, it would have stayed among the experts and engineers. But the Royal Institution is almost a holy venue, if you can have such a thing in science. Ambrose Fleming was just outraged. He called it scientific hooliganism to interrupt any kind of demonstration.
This took place in 1903. What was the course of wireless telegraphy? When did it become a practical application?
It already was short range. Its major application was ship to shore. As ships came up to the western approaches of England, they would radio to shore and say, I've crossed the Atlantic safely, I have a load of coal, whatever. After Marconi showed he could do the transatlantic broadcast in 1901, a lot of people didn't believe him. Basically. So he went on a program of public demonstrations, which started with this one in 1903.
But the inherent security flaws that Maskelyne revealed in 1903 didn't immediately go away. When was that problem solved?
That problem was solved by coding messages so that people couldn't intercept them. The Nazis used the Enigma machine, and as we all know, that caused enormous problems until it was broken by some brilliant mathematicians and physicists who worked out how you could build a machine that would decode the rotor settings of Enigma.
So I glibly, to begin this conversation, compared Neville Maskelyne to the anti-sec movement. Is that fair?
In exposing major security holes in a technology the public depended upon, Maskelyne was very much a forebear of what we see today.
He did it just for the Edwardian lulls.
I think he did, yeah.
Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Paul Marks wrote about Neville Maskelyne and Guglielmo Marconi in the Christmas issue of New Scientist.
Coming up, some people are so important they belong to the ages. But who really owns them after they die?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to improve the accuracy and lessen the cost of voter registration. At PewTrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Just a few months after the death of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, a Chinese toy maker called InIcons is releasing an action figure of the tech visionary. Coming in at around $100, the 12-inch doll is an eerie replica of Jobs, complete with his signature jeans, black turtleneck, and glasses. InIcons was set to release the doll in February, but the UK's Daily Telegraph reports that Apple has thrown up a roadblock by threatening legal action. Apple has experience doing this. It killed off an earlier Chinese Jobs doll back in 2010. But the law related to the dolls of living people do not necessarily extend to the dead. Jeff Roberts is a legal writer for paidcontent.org. Jeff, welcome to On the Media.
Nice to be here, Brooke.
So at this point, has Apple actually filed any kind of lawsuit?
I haven't seen any complaint filed in the U.S. yet. I'm not clear where the Telegraph got their information, but I suspect at this point they're just sending a lot of very scary-sounding letters. In Apple's case, I wouldn't call it a bluff, but I'm just not sure how they're going to follow through in this event.
This is a really complicated area of the law. There are copyrights and trademarks, which extend beyond a person's life. And then there are personality rights, which don't necessarily go beyond the grave.
Copyrights and trademarks are used to protect artistic works, paintings and sculptures with copyright, and brands with trademark. But what about sort of dignity to people? What if I get into my head to make a Brooke Gladstone doll and start selling it on the streets in New York?
I would so love that.
Some may not and may regard it as an intrusion of their privacy, or perhaps think it's wrong that I'm using your image without your permission to make money. So in the mid-20th century in American law, there started to be a new species of rights called personality rights. A lot of them are focused on the right to privacy, and some are focused on the right to publicize your image. All states sort of have personality rights for the living, like you have a right not to be defamed. However, that law does not extend after you're dead. And then something happened in the last couple of decades. They've taken these personal rights, which are meant to sort of protect individual dignity, and turn them into property rights. And these are sort of commercial rights, the right to, you know, as it were, get rich off your image. Only about maybe 15 or 16 states have laws in the book. A couple more have them at common law. But some states, including New York, don't have them at all.
Right. And in terms of a doll, when I am alive, can I squash a doll in every state?
Yes. While you're living, you have a right to control your image. I can't go out and take your image and use it to sell, you know, cars or sweaters or whatever I should choose to sell. After you're dead, it's a different matter, depending where we're living.
Okay, so Steve Jobs, the name is not trademarked. The person is not an artistic expression and can't be copyrighted. So Apple's best bet, I guess, is to argue a personality right. But you say even there they don't have a case.
for Apple to do something, Steve Jobs would have allowed Apple to inherit his personality rights in the state of California. We don't know what's in Steve Jobs' will, and I don't think we ever will. I suspect Steve Jobs probably left those rights to his family, not to Apple. But leaving that aside, I mean, should Steve Jobs' children and his spouse decide to assign those rights to Apple and let it enforce those rights on their behalf, then they would be in business. However, that will apply in California. It's not going to apply in New York, though.
Because California has strong image protection rights because of its celebrity culture?
That's exactly right. There's an act named after Fred Astaire from a decade or two ago that actually extended these retroactively to dead people.
Isn't there another case happening right now involving Hebrew University and a costume company in New York City? And the face of Albert Einstein?
That's right. Einstein bequeathed his general intellectual property rights. And since then, that university has been very aggressive about suing anyone who would do something with Albert Einstein. I think they have a trademark to the name Einstein. They probably have a trademark to, you know, mustache and glasses, something like that. Needless to say, they're running around enforcing it everywhere they can and making a lot of money.
Einstein left his papers and literary rights to Hebrew University, but he died in New Jersey, and under Jersey law, a person has a right of publicity only if he or she commercially exploits their name before they die, according to the costume company's lawyer. And so Hebrew University can't inherit rights from Albert Einstein, which didn't exist at the time of his death.
That's what happened with Marilyn Monroe, a famous case here in New York a couple of years ago, where essentially the rights didn't exist, so the court found she couldn't have assigned them because they didn't exist when she was alive.
Einstein never made money off of his image, but let's face it, Jobs did. He was the face of Apple. He was the cynosure of all of that attention.
Very true, but I do find it interesting that he decided not to trademark his name. Some celebrities have. I believe Britney Spears has. A lot of them do these days. Steve Jobs was a very big supporter of intellectual property, so it would surprise me this never occurred to him. I just wonder if for him, maybe, trademarking himself was a bridge too far.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Brooke.
Jeff Roberts writes about legal issues for paidcontent.org.
Late in the afternoon of August 28, 1963, a young preacher stepped to the podium on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and looked out over the assembled crowd. Then Martin Luther King Jr. did what many preachers do, but never quite so memorably. Using a blueprint he'd prepared in advance, he built a sermon. The circumstances were exceptional. 250,000 people, a time tactically chosen, a show of strength and purpose, an implicit threat. But for King, it came down to a moment and a process he'd spent a lifetime learning, how to borrow and transform the work of others. To mark Martin Luther King Day, we're replaying a piece that examines precisely that process. This from On the Media's Jamie York.
Working from his notes, King started moving quickly through themes and invocations he'd used many times before, starting with the Emancipation Proclamation and the Gettysburg Address, a reference to the Gospel of Matthew, and by the fourth paragraph, the idea of the uncashed check. This was an idea invoked most recently by James Baldwin and Malcolm X, the check uncashed, a debt still owed.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to whichever American...
Then King moved on, deploying the full range of his voice through a series of references to Gandhi's soul power, back to the Bible, repeating key phrases and pausing to hear the crowd's response so he could react accordingly. In those pauses, he came to grips with the conclusion he'd outlined in his notes, and around minute 11, he decided to improvise.
He's able to sit there, listen to what the crowd is saying, and realize that his conclusion is terrible. I mean, it's not going to work.
Drew D. Hansen is author of an analysis of the speech entitled The Dream.
And so right there, he's looking out at the crowd, Mahalia Jackson's behind him saying, tell them about the dream, Martin, tell them about the dream, Martin. And he looks up from his text and says, and so I say to you today, my brethren, so even though we must face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
And Clarence Jones is one of his aides, one of his speechwriters, is looking at, he's following along with the text. He looks up at that point and goes, he's off now. He's on his own now. And he just flies.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
On the one hand, King had acted on a spark of inspiration, and on the other, was employing a skill he'd practiced and honed. What many scholars believe King did in that moment was to abandon his written remarks and draw on one of hundreds of ideas, references, and sources that he'd committed to memory. In this case, an idea he'd been workshopping in front of audiences. The idea of a dream, a prophecy, joined with the riff on the song America, My Country, Tis of Thee, with lyrics Samuel F. Smith wrote in 1831.
This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, My Country, Tis of Thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing.
There was a tradition of referencing the song's irony in the face of racism. Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois had both done it. But King wasn't going that far back. King was recalling a speech black judging clergyman Archibald Cary had given 11 years prior at the Republican National Convention. Another memorable riff on America by Samuel F. Smith.
There's no question, you look at the two together, King's depending on that as his source. I mean, in some speech, King talks about how he gets this line from, quote, a great orator, close quote. I mean, he doesn't try to hide it. But then you look at what King does, and the material's totally different. I mean, Cary talks about the green mountains and white mountains of Vermont and New Hampshire. Well, that's a handful of words if you ever saw one. King makes it the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, right? He gets the internal rhyme on the short I of prodigious and hilltops. It's this nice, quick little phrase. I mean, there's no repeated phrase in Cary's original. Well, King takes it and he puts in, let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire.
Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania.
He'd spend his entire life studying techniques of preaching. And for the rest of his life, I mean, he and his friends from seminary kept on this running correspondence about the preacher's art. I mean, one of them would write to him and say, hey, I tried the ladder sermon where you take an idea and you gradually increase the level of your examination at it, or the jewel sermon, where you look at a theme from a number of different angles, like facets of a jewel. Rabbit in the bushes, where if you start going on an idea and you feel the audience responding, then you keep shooting at it, just like a hunter would keep shooting at the bushes when he sees them rustle to see if there's a rabbit in there.
Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
But what are the ethics of constructing your sermons from the raw material of any ideas you encounter? Keith Miller is the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources.
There were hundreds of books of sermons published by liberal Protestants before 1950, 1960. And in my research, I traced not only King's use of sources, but these preachers were borrowing from each other. So you can read one book of sermons and there's a quotation from Shakespeare, and you might think that the person was standing up all night reading Shakespeare, but actually the same quotation from Shakespeare shows up in book after book after book of sermons by different people.
And that's just the references found in the published sermons of white and black preachers. King, of course, came out of a parallel oral tradition of African-American preaching.
There's a long tradition of African-American folk preaching starting in slavery. Most slaves were forbidden by law to learn how to read and write. So they developed this oral tradition of songs and sermons, and some of the sermons during slavery were still being preached in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and were recorded on blues labels and sold. Somebody would find out an unusual piece of scripture that people hadn't used much before, and then they float from one book of sermons to another, and one imagines from one oral sermon to another in different contexts.
King saw the whole world as his source book. He didn't make some great fine distinctions between what was his originally and what was someone else's. He would take the material and he would transform it into his own, no matter where it came from.
Preaching, then, is an art whose first and foremost aim is to exalt God and move those in the pews. King used his oratory to construct common ground, drawing on references to political and religious morality that spoke to both blacks and whites. But the rules of preaching are in profound conflict with the rules governing intellectual property. King himself copyrighted the I Have a Dream speech in 1963. He directed all proceeds to the civil rights movement. But since his death, his estate, first his widow and now his children, have struggled with how to apply the law to King's legacy. Lewis Hyde is the author of Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. He says it's a real puzzle deciding how to treat Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech.
Whether it should be a public, like a public park open to all of us, or whether it's a piece of private real estate that it's appropriate to charge fees to enter. I guess I first knew about this because it came up in regard to the famous civil rights documentary, Eyes on the Prize. And in that instance, you find one case in which people wanted to use Martin Luther King's speaking and image and found it difficult to clear the rights for a reasonable amount of money.
Eyes on the Prize is but one example of King's estate monetizing and restricting access to King's written words, speeches, and likeness. Likewise, the estate has sued or demanded steep fees from academics, journalists, and news organizations, charging intellectual property violations. And almost without exception, they've won.
Martin Luther King's heirs have treated his created work as a commercial property. They have used King's work, sold it to advertisers. One example is a cell phone company.
A cell phone ad from 2000 in which King's speech is juxtaposed with Kermit the Frog and Homer Simpson.
And so this is a reformulation of King's image and message, moving it from the political and spiritual sphere in which it began into a completely commercial sphere.
Before you can inspire,
we hold these truths to be self-evident.
Before you can touch,
that all men are created equal.
You must first connect. And the company that connects more of the world is Alcatel, a leader in communication networks.
Hyde makes the point that the snippet of that speech that was sold to Alcatel is only 65% King's. The rest of the words are Thomas Jefferson's. No one I spoke to disputes that the King family have every legal right to make a living from the estate they've inherited. And where the line of commercialism should be drawn is a complicated debate. A 2008 study found that the speech was more recognizable to Americans than any other, and 97% of American teenagers recognized the words as King's. But authors like Michael Eric Dyson, author of I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr., fear that the recognition is actually counterproductive if documentarians, journalists, and researchers are denied reasonable access to the rest of King's legacy.
As a scholar, and as interested citizens, certainly I think that it would serve Dr. King's ultimate interests for the broader public to have access to his intellectual vision. And I think that's critical if we're going to combat some of the vicious mythologies about Dr. King that prevail.
Lewis Hyde thinks the risks are greater still, that King's speeches, the tradition he comes out of, makes an even larger point about how ideas and ownership enable or disable certain ways of being human.
And in particular, I'm interested in collective being. I'm interested in making it easier for people to be public and social selves, as Martin Luther King certainly was. The risk is that if we turn everything into private property, it becomes harder and harder for us to have these common or collective selves, which is something we need. In anthropology, there's an interesting resurrection of an old word, which is the word individual. So we live in a nation that values individuality. We live in a nation of individuals. But a individual person is somebody who's imagined to contain within himself or herself the community that he or she lives in. So it would be nice if we began to have a better sense of how to own and circulate art and ideas such that we could be present in our individuality as well as our individuality.
King was a genius as an activist, poet, and preacher who, to borrow a phrase, made hope and history rhyme. But for Hyde, genius like King's can only be fully realized when it has access to the world of art and ideas that King swam in and sampled from. This is our public selves, where our unique gifts contribute not simply to our individuality, but to better our community. And for Hyde, this potential is lost when we confuse categories and place ideas like King's, ideas he himself thought were divinely inspired, solely into the category of commerce. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.